We'll hear argument now in the case of United States against Cantrell.
May it please the court. I guess I am here on Mr. Cantrell's behalf seeking essentially the same thing with regards to both issue number one and issue number two. And that is seeking this court's assistance in obtaining his entitlement to, as the Gall court points out, an individualized assessment based on a true and accurate reading of his offense conduct, as well as an assessment on the entirety of his personal history.
Do you think that veterans should get lighter criminal sentences than non-veterans?
I believe the central point is that it should be considered. After I filed my initial brief, and as I point out in my reply brief...
I mean, it's an odd idea. You join the Army, which is fine. You serve honorably. That's fine, and so forth. And then you get a discount on your future prison sentences. Seems very odd incident of military service.
Well, as I cite Justice Wood, formerly of this court, it certainly goes towards an individual's character and their history. The Supreme Court...
It's like, you know, people steal, and maybe they give 10% of their theft to charity, and then when they're sentenced, they say, well, I want a discount because I'm a charitable person.
Well, the United States Supreme Court, after filing my brief, reversed a death penalty conviction because counsel was ineffective in not showing service of valor in mitigation. I'm not saying that it automatically entitles any defendant. I don't think there's any one thing that gives an entitlement to a lower or a higher sentence. I believe that it is a relevant, certainly meritorious issue, one of several which were raised at the trial level and that the trial court didn't address.
Of course, this is a person who knows better, right? Not some pathetic, you know, slum dweller grows up under terrible circumstances and really doesn't have a chance and commits crimes and so on. Right? This is a person, you know, is an official and prominent, and why would you want to give him a sentencing break?
Well, as
he knows better, right?
What's
his excuse? I mean, why would his war service give him?
It is not a defense to. I do not argue that it's a defense to criminal liability. I say that he is entitled to have that, as well as his absolute lack of criminal history, as well as the proper guideline considered and weighed by the trial court.
Well, the judge didn't mention these things. What's he supposed to say?
He is supposed to provide a sentencing statement so we know how and why he says 78 months is minimally sufficient. I suppose he could say, I afford no weight to military service, however much valor. I afford no weight to the Sentencing Commission's studies on recidivism, which distinguish Mr. Cantrell. He could assign no weight to all of those as long as he explained them. But Mr. Cantrell is entitled to that individual assessment per the United States Supreme Court. And the United States Supreme Court has said valiant service to one's country is one of the factors which can serve in mitigation, as well as having your offense conduct measured under the appropriate guideline, which would be, in this case, 2B1.1.
He said he considered the factors and then explained why he thought this was a particularly serious offense.
Yes, he afforded the government an individual assessment in aggravation while ignoring anything that would serve in mitigation. And I find that that is error. Yes, he used code words, but if code words, you will have every district court judge using those same quote code words and not giving individualized assessment, not finding sufficient but not greater than necessary based on personal characteristics and history, much of which the guidelines don't even claim, the Sentencing Commission never claimed, nor do the guidelines take into consideration many of those things. And with the personal characteristics...
I'm puzzled by that. The guidelines take them into account in an elaborate way, which is why there are all these additions and subtractions.
As to offense...
factors.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. As to offense conduct, the only personal characteristic is... that's taken into consideration is criminal history and the computation of the criminal history category. In fact, the guidelines specifically exclude many relevant personal characteristics. Thank you. I'll save the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Bella.
Your Honors, if it please the Court, I'm Daniel Bella, arguing this appeal on behalf of the government.
Is there anything we need to do, Mr. Bella, other than hold this case for the outcome of Black and Weyrauch and Skilling? If the Supreme Court knocks out the honest services fraud, presumably Mr. Cantrell will get the advantage of that. And, of course, what the Supreme Court says about honest services fraud will also determine the choice between 2B1 and 2C1, I should think, because if the honest services fraud goes away, this case now then falls under 2B1. So is there anything we really need to do other than just wait for the justices?
Well, in the government's view, not really, Your Honor. I think under the current state of the law, what the judge did was appropriate. He applied the correct guideline. And as I say, under the current state of the law, I think the government should win. Now, if the Supreme Court should decide differently, well...
Well, the question is not the current state of the law. The question is whether this Court has correctly understood the current state of the law.
Well, I would agree, Your Honor.
There are circuits all over the lot on the scope, meaning, and constitutionality of the honest services fraud approach. We've taken one position. Other circuits have taken other positions. The justices will take theirs.
Did the state of Indiana pursue any criminal prosecutions here?
No, Your Honor.
What? Do you know why?
Because the federal government acted. There would be no reason to prosecute this case again, I don't think.
Relying heavily on violating the Indiana law regarding conflict of interest. So.
Well, we rely on Indiana law to establish the duty of honest services that Mr. Cantrell owed. Especially the portion of the Indiana law with regard to conflict of interest and specifying what a public servant needs to do if there is a conflict of interest, that is to file a public notice of the conflict of interest. So the honest services fraud prosecution, as many of the honest services fraud prosecutions, first of all establishes the duty that's owed of honest services, and that's found in the Indiana Conflict of Interest statute.
What Judge Evans is getting at is something that bugs me, too, about cases like this. It's not so much why there was no state prosecution, but why the violation of state law, which is under honest services and, for that matter, the insurance fraud claim, ends up with a sentence about three times the sentence for the violation of federal law, the tax evasion counts. Isn't that a little weird? You end up with this federal prosecution not to vindicate the federal interest in having people pay their taxes, but to vindicate the state interest.
Well, I think society values the honest services of those in positions of trust highly.
Well, then you'd expect Indiana to be prosecuting if they valued it as highly as you say society does.
I think there are many areas.
Indiana's not exactly a criminal haven.
There are many areas of the law where the federal government steps in to prosecute, especially
public corruption
public
at the state and local levels.
Yes. And for some reason, the federal government seems to be more adept at making the decision to prosecute those than the local authorities. So so I think that's the reason why this ends up in federal
court.
What
would the guideline range be here if the theft guideline were to apply? And there were insurance fraud sections that will be unaffected by the whatever the Supreme Court were to do.
I believe that the appellants set that out in his brief. Frankly, I don't recall offhand what the guidelines would have been under the.
It's about half.
It would have been
what
less.
The actual guideline is. It would actually be more in line with what the income tax evasion sentence was.
It would have been less. And as I said earlier, I think the public society values the honest services.
A little, it's another thing that's weird. Maybe the Sentencing Commission will look at it, but it's not clear why honest services fraud has the sentencing range is so much higher than financial fraud. If you steal money from a local government, that's a low sentence. But if you are, you know, don't supply them with honest services but don't steal a dime, that's a high sentence.
I think that's
I think that's an inversion.
I think that's a product of the value that society puts on honest services. Let's compare robbery and theft, for example. I suppose that every robbery case could be prosecuted as a theft case, but not every theft case is a robbery case.
Well, there's a big difference between robbery and theft. I don't see robbery and theft being equated to honest services.
Obviously, those are both property crimes.
Actually, if you look at that, embezzlement from a bank, which is an honest services problem, has a much lower sentence than bank robbery, where a stranger comes in and says, stick him up.
Well, I keep returning to the same mantra, and that is that society values honest services.
Keep saying that, but then you ask the question, why bank robbery is sentenced higher than a teller's embezzlement?
And
you know, robbery is theft plus, but in Judge Easterbrook's example, there's a deprivation of honest services, but there is no theft of money.
We don't know if we're getting our best value, I guess, from our public officials if they make decisions based upon conflicts of interest. These contracts were entered into.
When they actually take money, that would be a much more tangible harm, since their honest services might not be worth a great deal, right?
I guess what you have to look at is how much more could have been done with this money had contracts been honestly drafted to help the poor people of North Township, as opposed to contracts being drafted because of the personal interest of Robert Cantrell. And so we'll never know what the public is out. And that's one of the insidious aspects of honest services fraud. We never know what we would have gotten with good and faithful service.
Well, and good and faithful are two different adjectives.
Well, I think faithful service would certainly be more to the good of the people than service based upon personal gain of the person making those decisions.
Well, we will see whether the Supreme Court takes the view that every corporate director's breach of the duty of loyalty is a federal felony.
We all could value things differently in our own personal view. Society, I think, values honest services highly. The sentencing guidelines certainly reflect that. And I think that the guideline that was applied was properly applied by this court. I think the court followed the proper procedures in applying the guideline. And I think there's no basis to reverse the court's application of that guideline. And I think the court adequately explained the sentence that it imposed and the reason that it imposed the sentence and the things that the court thought were important in this case in imposing the sentence that it did. So for all those reasons, I would suggest that the decision of the court be affirmed, and we'll await the outcome of the cases on the Supreme Court. Are there any other questions, Your Honor? Thank you.
Thank you. And Mr. Truitt, anything further?
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, on page 20 of, and I apologize for speaking and walking up here, on page 20 of my brief, I detail what the sentence would be under the theft or embezzlement guideline. It would be, the range would be 30 to 37 months, and that does take into consideration the additional two levels under Chapter 3.
What would be the statutory maximum?
It would be 0 to 20 years.
Could he upwardly depart under that guideline? That would be a departure, but he doesn't. we don't use that terminology, but could he say, you know, I know you've done all these wonderful things, but you know, you were stealing money and misappropriating money that should have gone for another purpose, so I think the guideline is top of 37 is too low.
Absolutely. I have never suggested that Booker, Gall, Rita, Kimbrough is a one-way ticket below the guidelines. It's an evaluation process. I've always, although it's from my side of the aisle, it fits my advantage that the Department of Justice always argues for guidelines. But certainly, Judge Lozano, if he properly weighed things, followed the procedure, could issue a variant sentence much higher. That's within the court's power. And then we'd be here in a substantive reasonableness review. But the also on page 20 of my brief, I detail cases from this circuit where Mr. Cantrell's sentence is higher than a public official that had Mr. De La Cruz, which had a $23 million theft, Mr. Black, who had a multi-million dollar theft, the Orsburns, who had a $368,000 theft. And I disagree with the government. The trial judge adopted the government's suggestion that, in fact, tangible amount of $68,000 as a result of this not filing this conflict of interest. They lost a tangible $68,000. Every trustee's office in the world gets at least $10,000 in federal money. That $68,000 is property under 1341. So, and that was the whole point of the Orsburn case, is that every employee-employer relationship, there's a fiduciary duty.
Yeah,
any theft
of course,
is a
Orsburn
breach.
Orsburn also said, counsel, and this was important to its rationale, that the Orsburns didn't take kickbacks, which we viewed as the paradigm of honest services fraud. And your client did take kickbacks.
I disagree. He was paid what, at its inception, prior to becoming an employee, was a legitimate compensation agreement. The government concedes that in the record, in the trial record. They don't charge it. Then he becomes employed. That creates either he has to disavow his salary from AFC or he has to disclose that he has an interest in that contract. But it remains unchanged. His compensation remains unchanged. The contract amount remains unchanged. He was not the decision maker. The trustee was. The trustee had the benefit of an attorney. He was an employee who did not make the decision. He lobbied, and that was his.
Let me ask you one question before you
sure.
sit down. Was there, as I understand it, there was never any objection to the applying the honest services guideline at sentencing?
No, trial counsel did not. And as I concede in my brief that it's a plain air review, but this court had just reversed this same trial court, this same U.S. Attorney's Office, this same probation officer and supervisor, and the statutory index references both to SEAP 1.1 and to B 1.1, and if nothing else, it is plain air that the probation department or that no one spoke up. These are the same cast of characters in the simultaneous chronology, and they should have at least done two guideline calculations. There should have been some discussion, but no, I concede in my brief that it is plain air, and it's a plain air review, but I believe that it passes that muster as well as if it were a de novo review. Thank you.
The case is taken under advisement.